Studying through the prophets, one of the things that you will quickly take notice of is that God is concerned about more than just Israel, more than just the nation of Judah, that God is concerned about all people. And while this doesn't come as a shock or a surprise to us, in their culture, it would have been very shocking. They had this mindset that when it came to a God, that he usually just oversaw a particular region. And the more powerful your God was, the larger of a territory you might conquer. When the Assyrians were going around laying waste to the countryside, they often spoke of the great might and power of their gods giving them victory. We find the Philistines doing something similar when we learn the story of David as he fought against Goliath, that Goliath was mocking the God of the Israelites because he believed that their gods were going to grant them victory. For the most part, many of the nations that surrounded Israel, when Israel began the cycle of sinning, and what we often call our judges cycle, they really didn't think that the God of the Israelites was a powerful God. And we find a number of stories where they would not just mock them, but even the Israelites would seem to find occasions to go to other gods to help them along the way. Even they began doubting the power of their own God. There's a few of the minor prophets that we read through that the message that was given was not ever even initially intended for the Israelites. The message was given unto the enemies of God's people. We have the minor prophets like Obadiah being sent unto Edom. In the case of tonight's lesson, we're learning about Nahum, who was not sent unto Israel, but sent unto Nineveh. He was actually the second prophet that God sent unto Nineveh. I know we're taking him chronologically out of order, but there's something about Jonah I want to say for us to make the last message of our week together. Nahum's message, however, I do think is of utmost importance because I believe it teaches us a lot about the nature of who God is. As I began looking through this particular lesson, one of the things that kept standing out at me was this idea that people did not know who God was. That's actually a thing we find frequently through the scriptures. Probably the most prominent was that of Pharaoh. When he asked the question unto Moses, who is God that I should listen to him? He didn't know who he was. He was not just simply saying, I'm unaware of who you're speaking of. Excuse me. But rather, he is saying that he is a God not worthwhile listening to. He is a God not worthwhile wasting his time talking unto his servants about what was good and what was bad for his servants. By the end of the plagues, I would argue Pharaoh knew exactly who God was. And he was not a God to be trifled with. When we get to the story of Nahum, I think it kind of begins that way. That Nahum was a God that the Syrians did not know who he was, did not recognize his power, his influence. And so God began his message unto them, explaining to them exactly who he is. And then he explains to them what's going to happen because of their sins. So as we begin our lesson, let's turn our Bibles over to Nahum in chapter 1. I want to read with you, beginning in chapter 1 and verse 2. The first verse is simply pointing out whose vision it is. Verse 2 says, the Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries and keeps wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. The Lord will by no means clear the guilty. His way is in the whirlwind and storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. He dries up all the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither. The bloom of Lebanon withers. The mountains quake before him. The hills melt. The earth heaves before him, and the world and all who dwell in it. Who could stand before his indignation? Who could endure the heat of his anger? His wrath is poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken into pieces by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him. But with an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of the adversaries, and he will pursue his enemies into darkness. That's a rather lot to say about who God is. In a book that details the events and the coming doom upon Israel, it would not be out of place for God to begin with identifying who he is. Putting these verses into context again is, I think, is important. Assyria never feared God. We need to remember that. They didn't fear God at this point. They never feared God. They didn't fear God at this point. These people never feared God. If they had feared God, they would have lived their lives differently. But they didn't. And God wants them to understand that He is a God to be feared, a God to be respected, because He is a jealous, avenging, and wrathful God. I suppose with those particular names that God attaches to Himself, these attributes that He attaches Him to Himself, for the Assyrians, that may not seem all that surprising. The Assyrians were a pretty wrathful people, and they believed gods, their gods were gods that were probably wrathful and avenging and bloodthirsty gods. And that's not how God is describing Himself here. But I could see where they would say, well, that's not that big of a surprise, that's the way our gods are. But to us, it kind of is shocking, isn't it? I mean, in our society today, how do people normally depict God? You're to give one word. I said, God is love. And He is. He absolutely is. He tells us He is. It's written to us in 1 John. And I'm not going to deny that He is. But God is more than just love. And it seems like in our society today, the only attribute of God that they want to focus in on is the idea of God's love. God is love, God is mercy, God is grace. It pushes this aspect of Him aside, and I believe it's become a forgotten nature. Well, I'm not saying that we need to fully focus our mindset upon the idea of God's wrath or God's anger or God's jealousy, but to ignore, I think it does the disservice to who God is. God is telling us that He is a jealous, wrathful, avenging God, then we should be listening. Yes, He will forgive, but He will punish those who are considered His adversaries. When we consider the first 10 commandments, the first of the 10 commandments, not only are they teaching Israel to have no other gods, but He explains why. You shall have no other gods before Me. Why? Because I am a jealous God, He says. Exodus chapter 20, verses 3 through 5. He said in Isaiah 42 and verse 8 that He will not give His glory to another. So what He's saying is that when we give unto others what rightfully belongs to God, God is jealous of that. So maybe put things in perspective for those of you who are married. If your spouse began giving his or her love to somebody else, how would you feel? Anger? Jealousy? Wrath? The attitude that God had here? Even though Assyria could make the argument that, hey, we're not God's people, God still expected them to honor Him as God. And that ties back to some things we could find in Romans in chapter 1. It doesn't matter that they weren't Israelites. The Gentile world should have looked at the world around them and knew God existed because of the invisible attributes of Him are seen in His very creation. They missed it. What I do find fascinating is that right after He tells them about who He is and all this anger and wrath that He has, He backs it up by saying that He's actually a slow to anger God. And so He's putting things in perspective for them. He's going to do something. He's going to punish them for their wickedness and He's going to punish them for their sins. He says, but I am a slow to anger God. Which means God did not jump to this conclusion, simply because He got a little bent out of shape. Well, guess what I'm trying to say is God's anger is not like our anger. Our anger generally comes from when we hear something we don't like to hear, or someone steps on our toes, or someone comments to the fact they don't like the clothes that we're wearing, or someone cuts us off at the stop light or the stop sign. That's when our anger comes out. God's anger is coming out because it was slow to come out. I mean, He wasn't quick to be angry with the Assyrians. He gave them opportunity. Of course, we go over the story of Jonah and see that being the case. Nahum wasn't the first prophet to go. But He tells in verses 4 through 6 that none will stand before His indignation. If He can dry up seas and rivers and break down mountains and hills, then who could stand before God? Who could stand against God? And the question really is rhetorical because no man could do those things. I mean, I don't care who you consider to be the strongest, most dangerous soldier that might pop into your mind. Could he move a mountain? Can he cause the seas to dry up and the rivers to dry up? And the answer is no, he can't. But God can do that and so much more. The question is rhetorical. The mightiest of the Assyrians could not stand against that. But he also tells us that God takes care of his own. That's what he tells us, at least in verse 7. The Lord is good and a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him. According to Nahum, God's people are those who take refuge in him. That is, God's people are those who trust God. They place their lives in the hands of God. And that's not an easy thing to do. I know it's easy to say it. Well, believe me, that's an easy thing to say. Countless times I heard someone say, well, I know that if someone were to threaten my life, I would never turn on God. I hear people say that all the time. Like, that's fascinating. You're willing to die for Jesus. And say, absolutely, I'm willing to die for Jesus. And I look at him and I ask him, when's the last time you lived for him then? Because I can tell you right now, you'll never be able to die for somebody until you live for that person. You want to know why you're willing to die for your kids? Because you spend every day living for him, sacrificing for him, doing everything you can to make certain their life is the best life it could possibly be. That's what it means to live for somebody. And if we're unwilling to live for God, then brethren, we're unwilling to die for him. To place our lives into the hands of God as a saying to God, whatever your will is, I'm going to follow it. It doesn't matter if it makes sense to me. It doesn't matter if it inconveniences me. I will follow you. I'll follow you to the ends of the earth. Who is God? He is a jealous and wrathful God who will punish those who stand against him. But he is also a God who longs to save his people. That's the kind of God he is. And after Nahum established the fact that God is someone worthwhile fearing, he explains God's true intentions unto the Assyrians. And this is where we get into chapters 2 and into chapter 3. This is where we find him describing the ruin of Nineveh. And I'm not going to take the time to read each of these verses. I'm going to quickly reference them here. Chapter 2 and verse 1, he talks about how they're going to be scattered abroad. Verse 4, he says that their enemy will race madly in the streets. That is, the idea is their enemy is going to come through and just conquer the whole area. Verse 9, he says their wealth would be plundered. Verses 11 and 12, he speaks of the complete ruin of the nation. The princes of Nineveh had been as lions. They were the kings of the known world. And by that, I mean they were the top dogs. You know, they were the top of the food chain. And no one dared rouse them. Certainly not in the lion's den. That was in their heyday. Nahum says those days are gone. In fact, when Assyria fell, it never rose again to the power, unlike other nations which God had punished. I always thought that was fascinating. Look at history. We see that rise and fall of nations. God tells Assyria they're done, and they never come back to any kind of power. The Roman Empire fell, but during World War II, they sure tried to rise back to power again. Egypt fell and rose on several occasions. Israel fell and rose on several occasions. But when God punished Israel, it was complete, it was final, they would never get another opportunity. He said in chapter 3 and verses 4 through 7, he planned to expose their nakedness. He planned on humiliating them, to publicly shame and disgrace them for their sin. In other words, he was going to make an example out of them. And others could look back at the nation of Assyria and say, this is why you don't turn against God. They were going to become a byword, much like Israel became a byword when the Assyrians carried them off. And much like Judah became a byword when the Babylonians carried them off, that people could look at the destruction and say, this is what happens when you stand against God. Thankfully, in the book of Nahum, he doesn't just point out the fact that they were wicked. Nahum gets down to the nitty-gritty details and he tells them what exactly it is that they did wrong. He begins by explaining to him, chapter 3 and verse 1, woe to the bloody city, all full of lies and plunder, no end to the prey. That's all that they were interested in was destruction. To listen to the description of the Assyrians is rather frightening. They would dye mountains red with the blood of the fallen. They cut the heads off of warriors and formed a pillar against cities. They burned young men and women. They impaled those that revolted against them. It was so bad that God says, your prey never departs. That is, there could never be enough bloodshed for their bloodthirstiness to be satisfied. That's the kind of people that they were. They were a city, as he says, full of lies. It means they were unwilling to tell the truth. Chapter 3 and verse 4, he speaks of their harlotry. This, of course, is not to be taken as literal, but rather as spiritual adultery. The terminology used, even as we looked at this morning, of that of Hosea and the sins of Israel. They enticed the world with things that were pleasing unto the flesh. They lured their men with promises of protection and riches and employment and comfort. And then once lured in, the defenses would be weakened by their attack. They would try to get people to follow after them because of all the great things that came from being a part of their system. God was not happy. Wasn't happy with their lies. He wasn't happy with their spiritual adultery. He was not happy with their bloodshed. And as I look at the story of Nahum, you might be thinking, but we're not really like that. But I believe that this message shares a stark warning to who we try to be, who we try to emulate, the kind of people that we end up walking as. Should serve as a warning to us that one day God is going to bring judgment. And that's the harsh reality. Judgment is coming. You might be able to sit there in your seat and say, well, Wes, I'm not shedding blood like this. I'm not full of lies. I'm not a person who commits spiritual adultery. I'm here worshiping God, and it's the only God I worship. But the Bible has a list of more than three sins. Go to Romans in chapter 1, Revelation in chapter 21 and verse 7. There's more than just three sins. There's a lot of them. And sure, there's a lot of things that might argue being related one to another, but the reality is we all have fallen short of the glory of God. Every one of us have sinned and are deserving of death as a result of our sin. Not one of us is righteous. Not one. Romans chapter 3 and verse 10. And because we are not righteous, God will eventually bring judgment. It is a place called the outer darkness in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 30. A place where there is no light. Have you ever been to a place like that before? You ever have the opportunity to go into a cave miles under the earth and have them turn out the light? I had them do that to me one time when I was down in, this would have been in Missouri. And they turned the lights off, it was in Arkansas, just across the Missouri border into Arkansas. We were standing by a ledge, and it wasn't a really big fall down. It was only like 5 or 6 feet. I don't think anyone would have been hurt had they gone over the edge outside of maybe some scrapes and bruises amongst the young people that were there. It's just, they said, I want you to see something. And so they told us not to move. They turned off the line. And we couldn't see anything. I couldn't even see my hand, like right, I'm blind anyways, but I couldn't see my hand right here. I couldn't see anything. That's darkness. That's a type of darkness which we can't hardly fathom. And what it's telling us is that hell is like that. There is no light there because God is light and His presence is not known in hell. I want to talk about something that's frightening and scary. Live in that world for the rest of your life. But you can't see anything. But he goes on to describe it as a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. Weeping is the idea of a lamentation or a cry of deep despair. The gnashing of teeth was an idiom used to express extreme anguish. So it's not just about being dark. It's a place where we have extreme suffering. That Jesus says in Mark chapter 9 and verse 4, the worm does not die. It's actually a quotation from Isaiah in chapter 66 and verse 24. The Hebrew word there for worm, incidentally, it's the last verse of the book. The Hebrew word for worm, is a worm that eats decaying flesh. That's the type of worm that it is. And the worm doesn't die. It's just constantly eating those cast into hell. The fire is not quenched. Tormented day and night, forever and ever. Revelation chapter 20 and verse 10. I tell you, our society doesn't like hearing these things. And I'd imagine that we start talking about hell and the suffering that goes on there, kind of makes us feel a little uneasy. Because we don't like talking about that. When we come to services, we like focusing in on the other side of things. We like to focus in on heaven and how wonderful it's going to be when we get there. And I think that's a good thing to focus upon. Remember when I was in college, a church that I worshiped with down there, Belmont Heights, they made a habit, the preacher there made a habit of at least once a month to preach a sermon on hell. And I asked him, why did he preach on it that much? It's because the society doesn't want to hear it. I preach on it that much because we need to understand the reality of the place. Because there are more people in our world today that believe in the existence of heaven than believe in the existence of hell. And I don't even know how that's physically possible. Because the same book tells me both places exist. The same Jesus tells me both places exist. And yet there's more people that believe in the existence of heaven than they do in the existence of hell. And perhaps one of the biggest reasons why people do not believe the existence of hell and a punishing God is because they don't believe that a loving God could punish somebody. Which I would say, according to the book of Nahum, this is possible because God is also a just God. This idea that everyone gets to go to heaven someday, it would be wonderful until you start really thinking about it. That's right. Everyone gets to heaven. That would mean that Charles Manson gets to go. That means that Adolf Hitler gets to go. You start listing off all these horrible people. And they get to go to heaven. Why? Well, because God's going to let everyone go there. So the person who lived their life to the fullest to serve God gets to die at the same table as a person who killed hundreds of people, thousands of people. Is that just? It's not. There's no justice in that. We have a just God who is going to punish those who do evil. But maybe the biggest reason why people convince themselves that God wouldn't punish is they think that God is the one who ends up doing the actual punishing. That it was God's choice to send us there. And I realize that in one way you could look at it, it is. But in the same breath, do you know why God made that choice? Because of the choices that we make. Galatians 6:8 says we reap what we sow. If we sow wickedness and we sow evil, we can expect to receive that in return. We can either choose the straight gate or we could choose the broad way. As Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 13, God tells us what the road signs are, and it should not come as a surprise to anyone what path we are on. Jesus said, by the words which I speak, you will be judged. John chapter 12 and verse 48. No one should be able to stand in heaven on the last day and say, I didn't know. We all know. We all have the right and the power to choose holiness or wickedness. If we don't end up in heaven, it's not an accident. It's our fault for not living the life that Jesus died for us to live. In the end, there's nothing that technically we can do to prevent it. Nahum told them as much. Nahum uses two ways to express to the Assyrians their destruction in chapter 3. Verses 8 through 10, he talks about the destruction of Thebes. Noamon was also known as Thebes, the patron city of Ammon. And Thebes was destroyed by Syria in 663 AD. God is basically saying to them, remember how everyone thought they were and how high and mighty they thought they were and how you brought them low? If they were not safe, he says, neither will you be. And he tells them in verses 11 through 19 of chapter 3 that their own resources cannot save them. Their strongholds will be easily shaken. Their enemies will rush through the gates as if they were open wide. Even if they prepare for a siege, he tells them, it will not help them in verses 14 and 15. In verse 17, he tells them their mighty warriors are going to fall. You might argue that what about the days of Jonah? Didn't God give them a chance? That's the whole point. He gave them their chance. There's nothing that can be done to save the city. Individuals, I believe, could be saved. But the city's days were numbered. Their time had come, and their time had run out. So we have to look to ourselves today. We don't have a prophet walking up to us saying that on XYZ date, destruction's coming. Jesus is coming like a thief in the night. And as nice as it might be, no thief is going to send you a letter and say, hey Wes, but to me anyways, just to let you know, on the 24th of September, I plan on breaking into your house. So be nice, you just make sure all those locks were unlocked, you have your safe unlocked, that way it'd just be a whole lot easier for me. Doesn't happen that way. I know, I've had my house broken into. It doesn't happen that way. You just come home one day and they're standing in the garage. Surprised. It's the way it's going to be when Jesus comes again. When we're not expecting it. No one's going to be able to say, no one should be able to say, I didn't have time. The time you have right now is your time to be made right with God. There's a sad day coming where people who thought they had time kept pushing off their opportunity to be saved will find out they didn't have the time they thought they did. I pray that won't be you. That you make the most of this time to make your life right with God. If there's any way which the elders here can help assist you in your relationship with God, I implore you to come forward. But together we stand and sing the song that's been selected.